From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, it's the Mark Haney Show on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And we do that by building the Backyard Advantage, the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. We like to share the stories of winning. Sometimes that includes some struggle, but often it includes a big dream and the steps along the way to achieve those dreams. And today, I'm really lucky to have Lucas Mijares. He is the co-founder and CEO of Zion Capital, and he's a young guy who has done really, really well in many aspects of his life. And so I want to dive deeper into, like, how do you design such a great life? And then we can talk about the different areas of our lives. And then if there's time, which I know there will be, we'll talk about the economy and how to face all the uncertainties today, because sure, you are obviously an expert in wealth management. But I mean, you also have proven that you know how to build a great life. And I was referred to you by your mother-in-law, Colleen, which is interesting because the mother-in-law, you know, you have to do well to have your mother-in-law be so impressed with you that they need to, go around introducing you. So that's a compliment to you and a compliment to Colleen for recognizing that too. So,
oh yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Heck yeah. Well, there's so much to dive into. Why don't we get an overview of where you are today, how you ventured into entrepreneurship, and then we'll kind of get into the design. How do you design the life like this?
Sure. Okay, cool. So let's see. Well, the secret to all my success is my wife, Becca. We've been married for almost 12 years. Next month will be 12 years. And we are about to have our sixth boy.
Oh my goodness.
Our life is very full. Never a dull moment. Let's see here.
Are you Catholic or Mormon? Or,
we're Christians. We get that a lot. But yes, we are Christians. And we love kids. We love our kids. They really are joy. We have a very, very fun lifestyle. My wife homeschools all of them, which is crazy. Well, let me rephrase that. There's four little ones in the house. We're about to have our fifth little one. Matt is 23, not biological, so he's not being homeschooled. Matt's an awesome college graduate and now works full-time at Zion Capital. Zion Capital, I'm the co-founder, so I own my own investment firm, which has been too good. Scary as heck, such ups and downs in the emotional category, but now sitting here almost 2.5 years later from making the jump, man, God is good. It's been so crazy.
When you say scary, are you talking about the fear of leaving something, I'd say more steady or a household name brand and starting on your own? Or is it you're scared of what's going on in the markets?
Oh, no, not that. The markets are resilient. Yeah. I don't worry too much about that. And we're doing financial planning and our focus is mainly retirees and entrepreneur business owners. No, the scary part's what you said first. So I had a very much storybook career. So blessed. I worked at Edward Jones, and Edward Jones was a phenomenal company, still is. And I left there to pursue something that I thought was better for my clients. No shot at Edward Jones, but I'm affirmed, and that decision was very much confirmed. And I was able to put everybody else first at the risk of losing everything financially. It's scary to create your own brand, and I think when you're an entrepreneur, whether you think you're creating your own brand or not, you are, right? Because the brand kind of comes back to who you are, how people view you, how you carry yourself. And so, like, for example, Mark Haney, you could go start a company tomorrow, and you probably will, knowing you, and you have already been building this Mark Haney brand. And sure, there's all these different companies of, you know, Haney Biz and the Growth Factory and you name it, and Haneyville or Haneytown and all that, right? But all those kind of have come, and it's been this snowball effect. I would imagine you can relate. I feel very similar in all those moments, even at Edward Jones, giving back in leadership, pouring into others, having so many people pour into me. Kind of, I'm a big fan of always being mentored and always mentoring someone else. There's so much that, if I could give anything back to other people, whether they're younger, older, indifferent, One, first of all, I'm probably stealing an idea from someone who's been mentoring me and passing and paying that forward. But I just, you know, I feel very blessed to be in the position I'm at now. And I also feel like I'm just getting started.
Yeah. Is there somebody specifically that mentored you that was game changer besides your wife, obviously?
Sure. Yeah.
But is there other people or is there someone special that you look up to?
Gosh, too many to count, truly. Not to say that to over-categorize it, but just I have a lot of people in my life who have been big fans of me. And I say that, gosh, humbly, just meaning they've rooted for me. My dad being the biggest one. I sadly lost my dad. He passed away this year in January. And so that's a bit of a kind of out of nowhere thing that happened. But my dad always, when I was at Edward Jones, he just always kind of said like, when are you going to start your own thing? When are you going to start your own thing? And you know, what's funny is I pushed back on it a long time and, I felt, you know, like I didn't need to. And I'm not sure if you want to go into that actual leap or jump or anything like that.
Sure.
But my dad was always instrumental in that. And it wasn't like he was disappointed in what I was currently doing. It was more just that he really believed in me and he felt like I had a gift of leadership and a gift of excitement and kind of a contagious energy that quite frankly I could use to then capitalize and build on to then really pour into others even better than I was already doing. And I feel like that's true. I feel like I've had a big just I'm an achiever. Do you know what the Enneagram exam is or the psychological test? They give you all these different numbers.
I don't think I do.
Okay. You're probably like me after listening to you a bunch, but I'm someone that likes achieving something. So if you give me a scoreboard, that's dangerous because I want to win and I want to know what my score is. I want to know if I'm doing well compared to others or compared to just even myself. And so it's funny at Edward Jones or just any other company, there's usually some sort of metric you can follow. And so that worked really well for me. When you go out on your own and you're a pioneer in your own thing, you have to create your own scoreboard, which can be challenging. And so I'm always one of those ones that's trying to push the needle forward, push the ball down the field. But then also the double-edged sword comes with not smelling the roses every once in a while and just stopping and pausing.
Yeah. Well, your dad recognized in you something special, your gift, one of your gifts, which everybody's got gifts. And sometimes we don't recognize them in ourselves. And I always think that that's a key part of parenting is helping our children recognize their gifts. Sometimes that requires honest feedback, but it also means staying open-minded to maybe the way your parents treated you. It means looking for the good stuff because nobody's great at everything.
No, not at all. And I completely agree. And it's something that having multiple children, you know, you have two kids. Are they the exact same?
No.
Of course not, right? And they were not designed that way. And so with my kids, it's even though I know that, I still sometimes am surprised at different personality traits. Even as little kids, right? They're interested in different things. And some of them have commonalities, of course, and top-down leadership, right? If Becca and I are into something, there's a good chance that a couple of them are going to be into the same thing. But I think that just having that... So I'm one of five boys myself. And again, we're all different. All come with different strengths and weaknesses. And I'm the baby of the family. And there's also a bit of an age gap. So I had the advantage to having not only my mom and dad, but four older brothers. I had the advantage of having lots of friends in a fairly tight-knit community of, you know, sports and church and different commonalities and places where people just poured into me. And then I think that was met with, I've always been a coachable kid. So I still hope to always be coachable. And if there's two characteristics I want my kids to have, it's confidence and the ability to be coached by anybody. And I feel like I've had those two characteristics pretty consistently in my life. And they've bared a lot of fruit because of it. Mm-hmm. You still get punched in the mouth, right? You still get those gut checks and reality checks. But I think with enough confidence, sometimes faking it till you make it, you can see those more as just speed bumps rather than derailing the whole plan. And it really, and that was something that my dad always really poured into me of just, you know, like, hey, the trials are going to come. That's irrelevant. It's not if, it's when. How are you going to handle it?
Mm-hmm. You know, an overnight success takes thousands of nights. And so you are, how old are you?
30. I'll be 34 in a couple months.
But you, were you on Forbes magazine as somebody?
Wasn't a magazine.
I mean, you've been recognized as somebody really successful that's very young for how much success you had.
Thank you. And that's nice of you.
Yeah. And I think that that's a testament to you. But I sort of wonder, I mean, obviously you're helping people to plan their financial lives and how it fits with the rest of their lives. But would you agree that you mentioned the word snowball? Would you agree that you got to start chipping away? The earlier you begin chipping away at wherever you're going, the sooner you'll get there. And then it's not going to happen really quickly of the time.
100%. I mean, if we were sitting here 10 years from now, there's a very good chance I'll look back at, you know, this last decade and realize that there was continued snowball success. Yeah, Becca and I got married at 21. Maybe this is controversial. I don't know. It seems like people are getting married later and later, but that was the best thing that we ever both could have done. It really put our feet to the fire. One, we genuinely wanted to get married. We loved each other and like still do. We have, ever since I met her at 18, we have been attached at the hip in the most healthy, awesome way possible. She's my best friend. And I don't say that because she's going to listen to this one day. I mean it. And I think that initial partnership, having someone on board with you in the fire, like my wife is on everybody's A team. She's someone you want in your foxhole, no matter the circumstance. I don't care if she's versed in it or not. She's your calm, cool, and collected, full of intensity woman who you'll follow anywhere. And so just with that, we started this partnership very early as a entrepreneur. I've always been entrepreneurial. Zion Capital has been my third time I've really pioneered like a brand new startup, something. It's for sure the most successful. And, you know, I can't imagine really life without it at this point. It's kind of crazy. Getting the direction of like how we started early, that matters because of momentum. Now, that doesn't mean that someone couldn't start any time in their life, right? It's like I'll have people come into my office and say, hey, is it too late to start? So, well, it's like planting a tree. You know, the best time would have been 25 years ago. The next best time is today. Let's get started. And so in my personal journey, though, I was still going into my senior year at college. Becca and I both went to Biola University, private Christian school in Southern California. She was a teacher. So Becca supported us as I was a full-time life insurance agent in Newport Beach in SoCal, and taking 18 units of school. She was a full-time high school math teacher down at Orange Lutheran High School and a assistant varsity basketball coach. We lived very fast paced, grind mode kind of jobs or lifestyles, no kids yet. And then throughout that process, I actually got recruited to come up here to Edward Jones. And we came up here, and in Edward Jones is known to, when you're in the beginning stages, they promote door knocking still. So going door to door, businesses, communities, man, talk about putting your feet to the fire. Yeah. So I moved up here knowing no one, which I think was to my advantage, actually. And I threw on a suit and I went door to door in arguably every door I could knock on in Nevada County. And it was crazy, Mark, how well that worked. You would think it was nuts. And believe me, maybe this is just my positive, optimistic mind that's remembering the good. There was still 99 no's out of 100. But every time I got that one yes, or that one yes to even get someone's phone number to follow up with them, just lit me up and gave me like all the hope in the world to keep going. So I started so young doing that, we almost didn't know any different. And we were broke. There was one point when Edward Jones gave like a scoreboard where you could compare yourself to the peers. And I was in the top 1% in the country for my tenure. So like as like a new guy. And we were broke. We had to move back in to her mom and stepdad's house. And then, you know, 6 months later, save up and we were able to buy our first house. And it was just, it's kind of a crazy journey to see where we're at now. We just kept our heads down. Becca supported us until I got really everything going as a financial advisor. And then we had that cross, and we still had a couple babies during that time. And then we had this crossover where it was like, yeah, like we got this. I'm not stopping. There's no plan B here for me. And her dream job has always been to be a stay-at-home mom and pour into the kids. And so from there, that snowball began. And yeah, we've just really never slowed down.
I sold my companies 10, 12 years ago. I had some security companies that I sold, and that was kind of like in between deciding what I wanted to do. Before that, it was, you know, I'm in my mid 40s at that time, and I guess it was a while ago. but it was kind of like starting over. And it was interesting to think about how to design the rest, let's call it the second half of my, you know, the back nine in my life. And I decided that was the first time I was ever really like conscious about, okay, if I could do anything I want, what would I do and how might I go about it? And I decided to build from the inside out, right? For me, that's around my health, my family, my friends, my community. And if I can make a living doing that, you know, I'm going to have a great life. And I know faith is at the, is a foundational piece for both of us, but I know you're really involved with your church and running the ministry at some level. Let's talk about your foundation. Sure. And how you, I guess, arrived at what that foundation looks like.
Yeah. So I grew up in a Christian household. My dad read the Bible to us all the time. There were flaws in that. You know, it wasn't this picturesque thing. Believe me, there were plenty of times when, you know, I did tell this to my dad's face. So I don't feel like I'm gossiping, but just like I didn't always agree with the way that it was always gone about us. Not that we were this like crazy strict household, or I mean, we had definitely parameters and boundaries, but just very much my dad never wavered. That's for dang sure. So whether you agreed or not with the style, man, my mom and dad were firm. They still, my mom still is firm in her faith. And we went to church, and that was what we did. And so it wasn't like I had ever had an option until I was really an adult. And, but yet I also just, I always felt like this, this pull to Christ. And it wasn't, I didn't have a testimony of like the worst life, and I was on the streets, and oh my gosh, and then God showed up and everything turned around. I really felt like just almost like a no-brainer, like why, how would you not believe this? And yet struggle with a lot of people struggle with was the hypocrisy that any person of any religion is going to have because we're not perfect. And yet, you know, Christians sadly have a stigma of there being a lot of hypocrisy. And so kind of dealing with that as a kid, struggling with that, being bothered, going to church and seeing people do dumb things, falling into those similar dumb rebellious things as a, you know, middle school or high schooler, forget how old. And then really when I was 18, I asked to get baptized at my church down in Southern California, down at Pirate's Cove, which is a super famous spot actually down there in Corona Del Mar area. And I really felt like that was where everything changed, where actually it felt like, hey, I know I grew up in a Christian household, but this is me choosing this for me. And it's a declaration, you know, when you're baptized, it's not like you're saved in that moment. It's a declaration saying like, hey, this is me, Lucas Mijares. I'm choosing to follow Jesus and live my life that way. And that was at 18. And so did that mean that from there on out, I was perfect? Gosh, of course, no, I messed up today. Just more that I think that's where from a foundational standpoint, like I grew up, I had kindling around the fire in my household. I was influenced in a good way compared to a lot of people like that's already such a head start. And then from there, I chose to make that like really like very serious. I went to Biola, again, more kindling in the fire. Was it a perfect school? Is everybody that goes to Biola a perfect Christian? Gosh, no, of course not. So it's not the way it works. But I was still influenced in those really good, healthy ways. And then when Becca and I got married, she's also a believer. And we just like put our hands together like, hey, man, if we're going to have a 50-year marriage, it's not going to be because of us. It's going to be because we both have, it is a phrase called vertical marriage. And not to get too preachy on you, but yeah, it's my foundation where just we feel like, hey, if both of us have a priority of following Jesus, we're going to be really good for each other. Meaning if it's honoring God to love my wife and to honor her, then I'm going to do that. If that's like what my perspective is. And then if both of us do that, no matter how many children we have or fostering or anything, we are going to be great leaders and great parents in that way. Are we perfect? Gosh, no, far from it. But do we absolutely try our best? Yes, absolutely. And so, now I'm 33 and there's been that similar compounding. I don't think I've ever slowed down the last 15 years. I hope that if we were sitting here 10, 20 years from now, I'd have the same story. Just a priority in my life. And that's spilled through now to Zion Capital. Do we pray over every client when they walk in? No. This morning I did though. This morning I got to have two people come in who are dealing with something really, really, really hard physically. And it's just, you know, it affects everything. And what's so cool, Mark, is my job. I get to sit like this with people in a closed room environment, having confidential conversations. And money is interesting. Money is arguably one of the most important things that we all have. And whether it's a conscious or subconscious thought, it's a resource that's necessary in some way, shape, or form. And maybe next to our children, our spouses, you know, the financial impact of what we have really can kind of steer how we have our lifestyles. And so when clients come in, man, you can have someone with not a lot of means come in and they're just super joy-filled. And the opposite is true. I'm sure you know these people where you could have all the money in the world and just feel so empty inside. And so now at Zion Capital, we get to teach stewardship. We get to teach the responsibility of having this money. And what is it doing? What is it? If this is just a tool and a resource, well, how are you using your tools and resources? Are they blessing you, your family, others? I fortunately, now our business has grown to a point where we are dealing with more high net worth clients. And they have the means to give back. And a lot of people say it. And it's not even that they don't mean it when they want to give back. They almost don't know how. And so we've become a bit of a liaison helping people even like save money and taxes by blessing charities that they really want to pour into anyways. And then teaching clients like, gosh, you realize if you just pulled these kind of levers, not only would you save money and taxes, your dollars of saving money and taxes could also go toward this something that you're really passionate about already. Yeah. And so seeing those light bulbs light up and that's where I go back to the foundation of what I do. Really, if I'm just my consistent, authentic self, then that's going to spew out in everything I do. And I feel fortunate that I have a company that gets to, you know, that's play great. Out without me that's having great. To put on a hat or fake something.
So you also live on a family compound, if I'm not mistaken.
Almost. I told
you. I know
you
have a bunch of kids, but yeah. What's that look like at your place?
Uh-huh. Yeah, so we're building the compound. Okay. We live on a private road and we have 5 acres and then we just we bought the 5 acres across the street. It's just land right now. We have big plans for that. And then down the street we bought a house that hopefully our brother and sister-in-law are going to move over there soon. Nice. But in our little town of Penn Valley, Rough and Ready area. I do live in a city called Rough and Ready, California, believe it or not. We have a big extended family. So Becca's side of the family, big, blended, complicated. Like Colleen, for example, she's my stepmother-in-law, believe it or not. By the way, her name's Nani around our parts.
Nani.
Nani's her.
That's instead of grandma, it's Nani.
Yeah, it's Nani. Because my kids have a few grandmas because of just the blended family. But it's the most beautiful mess you've ever seen. So back to the compound part, every Monday night, Krista, my other mother-in-law, she hosts family dinner, gets everybody together. Because we have a million people in our family, there's a birthday once or twice a month, right? We always have an ability to get together. And believe it or not, we really don't get sick of each other. Or maybe I don't get sick of everybody. Maybe a couple of them do. But we have a really fun thing. And because Becca and I love that together, it's not a stereotypical like, ugh, gotta go to my mother-in-law's house. Like I genuinely am excited to be there. And I'm not just being pulled because it's what my wife likes to do. We both are in unison in that. And we want to create that with our kids. And so having the property and having this area and Rough and Ready where if we can, we kind of always had this mindset of, hey, if we build it, they will come. And if we have the fun house and we have the fun pool, we have the fun yard, it'll be just where our kids want to be anyways. And then all their friends come to our house. And we've really found that to be true.
We've seen that in our house yeah. too. We have something we call Haneyville, which you mentioned earlier. Yeah. And so my two kids and all the grandkids live out there. And my kids are social, and their children have, you know, have personalities where their friends come over and that kind of thing. And so as the grandparent, you get to be more involved in the younger people's lives
right.
if they're closer in proximity and they have the personality types to be inclusive. And that's how our family operates. And so it's really, for me, that's a really special part of what my wife and I have kind of designed in our life. And, you know, you've raved about your wife, and it's obvious why, but nobody builds a truly great life alone, of course, but nobody builds a truly great company alone as well. You have a business partner.
I do.
And you have people that are along by your side.
Yeah. Yeah. So my business partner, his name is Jesse Etlin. And he's become a brother to me and an uncle to my kids and his wife, Miranda. And we've gone through this fire with him. He was also at Edward Jones. And so I remember the day, he was my best friend, and I kind of recruited him to Edward Jones in the first place. And I remember telling him, like, hey man, I just got back from this Forbes conference where it really shook me of just realizing how much more I could be doing for my clients, comparing myself to some of the other peers that were at that conference. And I told him in confidence, like, hey, you obviously can't tell anybody, but I think I'm going to leave. And his first response was, is there room for two?
Wow.
And it was like, really? And we really, like, it's almost like you took a blood oath. You're like, hey, there is no turning back. This will not fail. We will make this happen. And we did. And by the way, the launch of this is very tricky. You ever seen the movie Jerry Maguire?
About 1,000 times.
We had a very much Jerry Maguire atmosphere. It's a free to work state.
Oh, okay.
But we can't solicit our clients to come with us. They're Edward Jones clients at the end of the day. And so the way we were legally allowed to do it was just to call and let them know that we left. And you just had to pray that they said, why can I come with you? Where did you go? Although, we had legal counsel and all this. And every time they were like, we only had a couple people not really want to come. But, again, building that brand, Jesse and I were just, we had to fall on just, hey, we're going to just kind of trust fall this process. And if in the same way I think about my home attracting the kids, if we build it, they will come. If we make Zion Capital something special, people are going to want to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. Even if someone's skeptical, right? Like, for example, if you, Mark, said, hey, I'm starting this company tomorrow and it's about this most obscure thing, and you tell me about it and you're like, you interested or something like that, I might think it's the craziest idea in the world. Like, that's not going to work. But man, if Mark's in, I guess I'm in. That's the kind of lifestyle that I want to have as a leader, is I want to pour so much into other people, whether I'm the husband and it's my wife following me, I'm my kids following me, or you name it, whether it's Jesse as a business partner, whether it's our wonderful team of Matt and Veronica and Janessa. If we are building something special and we are authentically excited about it, and by the way, it's something that's so, like, good. It's a good thing. We're not charging fees on the backs of people. Like, we are genuinely getting paid to help people do something really powerful with their money. And if you build something like that and you're authentically excited about it, it's no wonder it's grown. It's, you know what I mean? It's like, we're not faking anything. This is us every day.
That reminds me a little bit of the Growth Factory. We've been doing the Growth Factory for the last 3 or 4 years. And it started with this podcast, which had been doing for 10 years,
yeah.
Made a lot of really interesting friends and very high influence type friends. And you know what? they saw that I was trying to help the startup community around Sacramento for the last 10 years. And when we decided to start our fund, we had people that just wanted to help. Mark, I want to help you to help other people. And I believe that you can make investments that in startups that can have an impact and get us a return on our investment. It's gone really well. But I'm playing off of your point of, I'm not a seasoned venture capitalist. I'm a security camera salesman who's kind of started a lot of companies and involved in all these different areas. And when we started to take other people's money and invest it, huge responsibility, of course, but I'll be forever grateful for the people who have said, yeah, I want to help you out, or yeah, I believe in you. Even though this is a risky asset class, I believe in you. And so far we've done well, but this is not a solicitation in any way, but so far we've done well. And it's really gratifying to have built the brand that people believe in you, or at least take a shot on at you.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's where I know I've said this a million times, but I genuinely mean it. I just feel blessed. I feel honored. And it's a sense of gratitude of just, wow, people really believed in me. They really trusted me. And now for me, because I'm a competitor and because I like achieving and I like having a goal, it's now just affirming everybody's choice to say yes and come and hire us as their financial planner or whatever it is. And every time you get that yes, it's a vote of confidence and a vote of trust. And I just think that's special. And I know you're interviewing me, but can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
It's really relatable in this sense. So you built this family compound and your kids chose to say yes and agree to live next to you. And you've talked about having the big sliding glass door and being able to kind of view all of it. And I think that's just awesome. That's totally a dream of mine, is to have everybody here. But I think, and what's your wife's name? I'm sorry.
My wife's name's Stacy.
Stacy. So it's a testament though to you and Stacy and the foundation that you guys built to attract your kids and their spouses to want to be a part of that. Because you know this, they could have easily said like, oh, that sounds cool and don't worry, we'll visit for holidays, but we really want to go a different direction. And they chose to stay here. They chose to, and I know both of them are talented and very much in leadership positions because I've heard you talk about them. And I think that's really special. And so my question is, what did you and Stacy do? Can you put your finger on anything that really made them, as you know, as when they're kids, it's easy, but when they're adults, a different story. So what do you think, what was it that made your kids really want to be a part of all this?
It's a good question. We didn't involve our kids in the family business. My brother and I had businesses together and we intentionally kept the kids out so that there wasn't a division between he and I based upon, because his kids are about my kids' age, a little bit younger. We kept them out. So it was nothing they learned at work. I think what they saw was unity around the house, the commitment between my wife and I and our family members, our extended family members, like me and my brother and you know, her and her brothers and sisters and mom and dad and stuff. And just the deep commitment to the loyalty within the smaller unit of the family. And I think they just were built that way because they saw it, they lived it, they were friends with their cousins and they liked that. And we made these things like traditions in terms of like getting together and, you know, Sunday night dinners and those kind of things. And so they saw that. And I think that they appreciated that sense of structure, I guess. And so now today we attempt to do that as well. The one thing about my two kids is they're very, Scott will tell you, they're extremely competitive. And so I'm just hoping we don't kill each other out at the property occasionally. But right now it's going pretty well.
But
deep down they would kill for one another. That's how they are toward our family. That's just the way that they operate. And I think it's almost like, I want to say it's in their DNA, but I think they saw it happen.
Sure. Yeah. You create a tribe.
Yeah.
That's so cool. I mean, how many grandkids do you have?
Seven.
Seven grandkids. Have you noticed that they have a similar competitive gene?
Each one of them is different.
Yeah.
So I would say I've seen it in a couple more than others, but sometimes people don't wear their competitiveness on their sleeve. And I would say you might be the type of person that is quiet, competitive. You know, you're very humble. you've got charisma and you've got certain attributes, and those are not demonstrating how competitive you are, right? You don't, you may, maybe on an athletic field, it comes out.
Yeah, or, I'm sure if you see me in a different light.
So I'll fire the question back at you. So sure. In terms of being competitive, I believe that the most successful people need to learn how to compete and that it's okay to compete. I learned, and my kids learned a lot of that on the athletics field. That's where I learned a lot of mine too. And I know you are
too.
An athlete.
Yeah.
And, so what's your game face look like? What does it look like when it's game on? Because most of the time you're being a nice guy, which is still, you're trying hard, but there's a trying hard and making sure that everybody gets what they want in life and so on. But there, when it's you competing, what does that look like?
Okay, so there's two different versions. There's the me competing and I'm me versus me by myself. Like whether that be an ultra marathon, you know, Spartan race type atmosphere, or like I recently did a High Rocks race. Mm-hmm. That is different because there's no team atmosphere. When there's no team atmosphere, I can go hard and just be my, and I can really, I'm pretty hard on myself in a sense of I'll know if I'm half, you know, wetting it. Like if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it right. And I go extremely 100, like I'm 100%, 100 mile per hour kind of guy. On a team or when I coach a team, I'm intense, but I need to know how the team's doing. So I'm a combination of, I'm a big strategist, but I'm also a rah-rah guy. And we're only as good as our weakest player in anything. And so I will very much be a leader and driver, but I'm also going to be the one to go in the back and run with the slowest person to pick them up and keep them motivated and keep them in the fight. Because if they drop off, we all of a sudden got weaker, right? You said, I see all these signs around here, and hopefully I'm not butchering it, but like no one built something good by themselves. Mm-hmm. What's the right way
Nobody
to say it?
Nobody builds a truly great company alone.
That's the one.
Yeah. We call them Markisms. I make up a lot of my own little mantras.
I love it. It's amen, man. It's true, right? They say, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go somewhere far, go together. And so I'm seeing this play out. I was always this way as a kid. I played lots of different sports and I was always like the quarterback or the point guard or the setter or in all those different sports, but also just whether I was the best player, which I wasn't, I don't know if I was ever the best player. I really don't think I was, but I was always solid and I was always a leader and a captain. So, you know, it's funny, even my senior year in high school, I wasn't even a starter. I became the sixth man. And which was fine because it was the best place for our team to be successful, but I was actually still the team captain, which is very backwards. Like any kind of sport, it's always like the best player is the captain. And it was something my coach saw in me, and it was something that I had even just as an 18-year-old. And you know what? Our team won the CIF title in SoCal. Wow. Got a ring out of it and everything. And I do think that I helped influence the culture. I see that culture play out in every little league or soccer, basketball team I coach. I'm the same way. I don't care if they're 5-year-olds or, you know, 15-year-olds. I love coaching, by the way. I coached like AAU when I was in college and I had a little break there. But now that my kids are of age of playing sports, I'm always their coach and definitely have, you know, a passion for that, of pouring into the youth. And you mentioned something when you're asking me the question about you taught your kids that competition's good. That is a lost art. I could not agree more. And Becca and I, man, if it's I don't care if it's a board game or a football game or a basketball game, we tell our boys, hey, if you're going to show up, you're going to do it 100%. If you're not going to do it 100%, like, you know, no way. And I don't care if you make a basket or you pass a test or whatever it is. But if the effort's not there, then we got a problem with that. And you don't have to be competitive in the sense of like, I'm going to rip your face off if we don't win this game. But we are going to try, especially when we're on a team, because, you know, if you're in isolation, you're playing golf or you're playing, you know, singles and tennis or whatever it may be, you're running a race. Well, at the end of the day, you're kind of disappointing yourself if you mess up. When you're on a team, you not trying or not performing or not giving it your best is actually now becoming selfish because you're hurting others around you. And we want our kids to know that what you do matters and what you don't do matters. Like, inactivity is still activity. It's still choosing to do something. And all of our kids are different and they're young, but there's already that heart, I think, that we're building in them of, hey, we're going to do things right. I totally have coaches' kids as far as like IQ, because we work on these things. And my wife is very, very similar. But she's more intense.
Uh-huh. She's one more of the things that's interesting to see the contrast between you two. And intensity is not a bad thing necessarily.
No,
I coached quite a bit myself, football and baseball mainly, and I haven't done it for the last several years. But I'm coming out of retirement. My son's going to be the head coach of the Del Oro Junior Eagles tackle football program.
Nice. So it's like
seventh graders, which is perfect. I can still run around with them a little bit, I think, hopefully at that age. And so I'm going to come out and help them out. But teaching them to compete is huge, but also how to do it with the right attitude, with a team first mentality, and how to have sportsmanship, because you're going to compete. That doesn't mean I tried so hard and it didn't go my way and I crybabied about it. It's like how to deal with adversity is a part of learning how to compete.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a great book, Extreme Ownership. You heard that?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that really, I don't know if it changed my life, but it affirmed my way of thinking. And when you're on a team, and I don't care if they're seventh graders or seven-year-olds, extreme ownership is a powerful lesson to teach them, because we live in a culture, sadly, where victim mentality can kind of take over all of our brains at times. And it's really easy to point the finger. But whenever we do that, if we hopefully have enough, head on our shoulders to say, okay, I'm really bummed at the way that person did that. And that really didn't set me up for success. But if I'm being really honest with myself, had I been better prepared, that roadblock wouldn't have derailed the whole plan.
Right.
Right.
That one strike just outside, call it a strike on me. I probably had some decent pitches to hit.
Sure. I was terrified of being late to this interview today. Right. So I'm driving here and sure enough, there's an accident. There's a roadblock. I still got here on time though. Right. But I easily could have, there's other times in my life where I would have been either barely on time or late. And man, there was an accident, Mark. I'm so sorry. It's like, well, sure, that is okay. We can give grace. Like, these things do happen. But if you plan for there to, just in case there was an accident, you wouldn't have been late if it was that important to you. I know those are very small things, but they're things that we teach our boys. And they're things that, as a leader, I really think if you care about the details, in between the boundaries, it's what creates special environments of culture. And then if you can create that culture of excellence, like, and you're going into your seventh grade football team, it is so contagious. Everybody wants to be a part of it. Kids want structure. And when you give kids structure in a strong culture where they can taste success and they can take, it's funny because I'll, in the beginning, really quick, whenever I coach these teams, now I have a reputation. But in the beginning, I send out this crazy long email to the parents before we even had a practice. And I go over the fact of like, hey, I am not God's gift to coaching, but I really care and I really love this. And I know we're just playing like a rec league, but here's some things that are really important to me, like being on time to practice, letting me know if you're not going to be at practice, letting me know if you're not going to be at a game. Here's three rules we're going to tell all of the kids on the first day, but I want you to hear it from me first, just so you don't think they're crazy when they tell them to you. And I would love if you could read this email to them in the first place. And I'll even put a little thing like, please reply and let me know that this got done. And inevitably, the first couple of practices, the new kids who don't know me are like, is this guy for real? And then now I feel like my kids are old enough where it's like, it's okay. And even the parents are like, oh no, trust me, you're going to like this. And I have this firm belief that when like someone steps on the court and I'm coaching them, they just became my son or my daughter. And in the most loving way possible, like, hey, now parents will just drop their kids off and be like, hey, you cool if I run the grocery store? It's like, sure, absolutely. They know though that I have boundaries. My yes means yes. My no means no. I'm going to be consistent as heck. And if you don't give full effort with a smile on your face and you're here to learn and get better, this won't be the most successful, fun rec league for you. And sure enough, Mark, every time we end up being really good because we created this practice culture of practicing and pouring in. And usually I feel like I'm batting 1,000% where no one left feeling miserable, like they had a bad experience.
That's awesome. All right, so we've got a few minutes left, but I wanted to make sure, because I teased this at the beginning, is the economy, and you're obviously helping people design their path for financial, their financial futures and even their todays. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of uncertainty right now. I guess it there always tends to be uncertainty, but let's just talk about where we're at today. We've got a new administration. We have a tax bill that looks like it's got a decent chance of, the tax cuts being permanent. It looks like we have a decent chance of having that happen. We have tariffs happening. We don't know the impact of those tariffs yet, because we've launched some tariffs, then we backed off on it a little bit. So part of the negotiation. We have interest rates that are climbing, gold spiking. How do you make sense of it all? There's so much movement in the economy. And then you throw in how artificial intelligence and technology is, having an effect on all of that. What do you do?
Yeah. So first of all, you and I and everybody listening to this have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow. Our markets are resilient as heck. If we're just talking about the stock market or the real estate market, we've never had a time ever where the market's gone down and it never rebounded in any market. And so I think a good just rule of thumb is to cut through the noise, turn off the talking heads. I deal with a lot of retirees who have time on their hands. And so
there's so much financial information coming at you from, they could be 180 degrees different in their opinions. It's like, oh, wow.
I am trying to have good eye contact with you, but behind your left ear right here is the stock market right here.
You got CNBC
on. So it's everywhere. And I think that the thing that we have to focus on is what we can control. So the economy, we're Team America. We're rooting for this thing to work. I don't care if you like the president, you hate the president, whether you liked or hated the previous president, or you're going to like and hate the next president. They are the leader. It's inevitable. We can't control it. And there's a trickle-down effect of all leaders. And again, whether you like it, you're not, there's 330 million Americans. Throwing a fit, not you or anybody, but anybody throwing a fit isn't going to help anything. And so having the economy have this bit of uncertainty, one, I'd argue there's always something to be uncertain about. Two, no one likes change. I don't even care if it's good change, right? You take someone from going on the couch to, they say, want to get in good shape. Great, but it's not going to be fun. It's going to be a really long, treacherous journey to get in shape. Well, if the argument is we're doing these things to help the country, it's not going to be sunshines and rainbows if it's actually going to help the country. Yeah. And so, whether you're a fan of tariffs or not a fan of tariffs, I think when someone can peel back the layers, understand the long-term purpose for Team America, you can make sense of it, but that doesn't come without a fight. And man, it's been a dogfight, right? Like, people reacted pretty sharply
Doge
in April.
Fight. It's been a dogfight. Yeah. So many things. But I agree. Yeah. We've gotten a little bit, the government's become too big. We're not managing our budget. And, there's all these things. And it's a little bit like being on the couch. It's like, okay, we're going to get up, move around a little bit. And it's, we're going to have some sore muscles.
Yeah. I do believe the economy will be just fine, though. I really do. And by the way, I've never met a successful pessimist. And so when we think about financial planning, it's my job at the end of the day to be a psychologist for my clients more than a brilliant money manager, because now we're dealing with something I can control versus not control. I can control how my client reacts, good or bad, having good behavior or bad behavior. There's these cool charts that you can look up. Anybody can Google it. But I'll just give you the example. In the last 20 years, the average rate of return for the S&P 500 has been about 9%, okay, roughly. The average return for the average investor has been 2.7%. Why would you argue that's the reason?
People being pessimistic?
It's people doing the wrong thing at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. It's trying to guess. It's trying
selling
to
time. It's on the way down and you're sold.
Yeah. Yeah. When things, clients will say, during COVID was a good example when the markets are dropping. I mean, gosh, the market fell 36% in 31 days. I'll never forget it. I think I got my first gray hair during that week, that month. I had a couple clients say, hey, I know it's down, Lucas. And I know I should probably be buying, but don't worry. I'm going to wait till it drops more. And I said, so you're telling me you're going to be excited to buy when the news gets worse. So in order for it to drop more, that means something worse happened. And now you're going to be magically confident to buy. And I just remember a couple of clients said like, hey, I'm trusting you. You know, if you really think let's do it, let's do it. And it's like, hey, I'm not predicting the future tomorrow. I'm telling you that this company we've heard of called Google, it's probably not going anywhere. And you know, this is not a recommendation to buy Google by any means. But just saying any company like you've heard of that's getting beat up right now, if it's about something that's completely out of our control, well, maybe it's just on sale. And it's helping clients just kind of think logically, like, you know, do you still use your cell phone? Do you still flip the lights on when you're at home? Are you still going on the internet? All these companies have to make money. You know, we live in a capitalist society where we are consumers, we spend money. And you know what's the interesting thing is that consumer spending still keeps rallying. So whether people have money or not, that Starbucks drive-thru is still so long. And it's not like everybody has a sticker on their car saying, don't worry, I can afford it. Yeah. Starbucks is happy to serve them, right? And so just going back to, you know, how do we navigate that? How is the economy going to do? I have no idea, but I'm rooting for it to do well. And there's a whole bunch of metrics I can look at. We can look at charts all day long. At the end of the day, we don't know. But we can learn from history, and we can see that, you know, those who are resilient, those who don't panic, those who consistently have their bed made, if you will, with a good foundation, seem to be the ones who end up doing very well. And then what's fun is when clients have plenty and extra and they have their, you know, metaphorical bed made, now they could come excited to someone like you and look for real exciting investments where, hey, high risk, high return. You want to play with the big boys and get some high risk? Well, maybe don't do that with your foundational wealth, that if you were to lose that, we'd have really big consequences. But I am a humongous fan of clients taking risk when they have their other stuff already working for them well. And so I would just say that those are good rules of thumb that I did not create. Those are timeless pieces of wisdom that as a young buck like me, I get caught up in so many things. People just assume because I'm young that I'm trying to give them advice that like some young person should do. And it's like, gosh, that's far from the truth. I think I'm an old soul. But two, I'd be silly to try to reinvent this wheel. We know what works, and it's our job to make sure our clients win more than they lose. And if we can hit consistent base hits, maybe every once in a while get a home run, we're going to be just fine. But if we try to hit home runs all the time, more strikeouts are going to happen than not.
I love it. Lucas Mijares, Zion Capital. The one thing I'll leave you is if you're watching this on YouTube, he mentioned brand, almost like building a personal brand at the beginning. And this is your business brand. Yeah, it's part of your personal brand too. So nice design.
Yeah, thanks, man. Yeah, we love our swag and we love our little pieces. It's a lot of fun going out in public and even seeing people wear stuff. Be like, oh my gosh. That's crazy. You're wearing a Zion sweatshirt or whatever it is.
That's awesome. Well, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark. It's a pleasure.
And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at the Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you. We're never below you. Always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.